Welcome back for the second hour of Time Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. In just 1 minute, we have an interview with Bob Mensinger. Want to explain to the listening audience, we recorded this interview with Bob, about a week or two ago. And after the interview, I was so impressed with Bob that I immediately hired him as my campaign manager. And so, although we don't reference it in the interview because it happened after the fact, I wanted to let the listeners know. So, without further ado, we will fade right into the interview. This is Bob Mensinger. He is now a campaign manager, but when I recorded this, he was involved as a journalist, as a writer, and he's formerly the managing editor of the Times Record and formerly the assistant city editor and city editor of the Kennebec Journal. My interview with Bob Mensinger. Listen to Time Smart Talk. We've got no sad news today, but we do have one of Maine's leading journalists, news people, former editor, and please join me in welcoming Bob Mensinger. How do you pronounce your last name, Bob? I just mangled it horribly.
It's Smith when I order pizza.
Let's go with Bob Smith, but technically it's not Smith.
It's Mensinger.
Boy, there's a lot of vowels and consonants.
Yeah, it's tough. I've lost about a year of my life spelling it for people.
So if I go with Ment and then go with Zinger and just kind of like hustle through it, I can probably make it through.
Should be fine.
Perfect. Bob Mensinger is, I messed it up again, award-winning writer and editor, lives in Brunswick, has a website, Bob Mensinger, WordPress. Long distinguished career in journalism from 2003 to 2011, assistant city editor and city editor of Kennebec Journal. For the last couple of years, managing editor of the Times Record. Now, just recently announced starting his own public relations media company, which we'll talk about in a second. But why don't we talk about the early years of Bob? And, I spent some time in New Jersey and I see that that's where you were born. So let's talk about how you ended up from growing up in New Jersey, and then ultimately what brought you to Maine?
Well, that's I wish I knew how that all happened. It's kind of was out of my hands.
Isn't life funny like that? Yeah. Like you get to a point and you go, man, what were the steps that actually brought me from here to here?
And
it's more like a pinball. When you look at it in retrospect, it's more like a pinball event than it is kind of some linear thing.
Right. Well, I was born in New Jersey and spent 2 years there, and then for the rest of my younger life, spent it in Connecticut, Madison, Connecticut, on the shoreline, and then they sent me to boarding school because they didn't know what else to do with me.
Where'd you go to boarding school?
It's called the Gunnery. It was in Washington, Connecticut, Litchfield County, small.
I went to a school, Berkshire.
We played Berkshire all the time in sports.
Yeah, it was Hotchkiss, Choate, Berkshire.
Canterbury.
Yeah. I made it about 1 year, and then in the spring, the dean came to see me and said, young Mr. Woods, we have we like to call it a policy. Maybe it's a standard. Maybe it's some other enforced structure. But it's really important that you study, and it's really important you attend classes.
Pretty strong hint there.
Really strong. And you think that they would tell you that in September and October. Because I'm half joking, but I went to prep school for 1 year.
I made it
1 year, and I was like, okay, well, if you're going to be like that about the rules, back to public school for me.
Gotcha.
But
and then after that, I went to school in Washington D.C. at George Washington University, got a degree in journalism and political science, and after that, did a lot of different things. Went to Boston and worked for a public interest firm up there called the Fund for Public Interest Research. It's basically a Ralph Nader group. It's basically 13 different state Ralph Nader groups that, seatbelt laws and, safer cars and things like that. After that, moved out west. I moved to northern New Mexico, one of those do it while you're young type of things. I became a ski patroller. I was an EMT for a little while. Wow. And lived that lifestyle.
Is it Down, New Mexico, or how do you pronounce it?
Taos, New Mexico, which any skier worth his salt will know exactly.
Isn't that where Julia Roberts lives?
She has a place there, yes. So does Don Rumsfeld and
Rummy. You ever bump into Rummy?
A friend of mine shooed his horses.
Wow.
Yeah.
He's an interesting figure, isn't he? And he still pops up every once in a while. Every time there's some sort of geopolitical conflict, he pops up and basically just slams anything that Obama's doing as being dangerous and it's awful. Mm. But he was, between him and Cheney, they were like the dark forces. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to his credit, I mean, the one slogan he came up with I actually kind of enjoy was, you know, there are things we know, and there are things we don't know, we know, and then there are things we don't know.
Of course. But when he said it with such sincerity and earnestness where for a second there, you thought you were...
He knew something.
He knew something. Yeah. And you felt almost guilty, like, I'm not keeping up. It must be I'm not operating high. But then when you kind of break it down, you go, it's just kind of gobbledygook, just kind of gibberish. So you did that, the ski patrol, Boston,
and really newspapers were always a way to just move. So when I went to New Mexico, I was able to get a job at the Taos News as a features editor at the paper. There was a weekly paper there. They have a big art colony there, and it's fairly well known.
Right.
From there, once I got tired of that, I moved back east, got a job back in Washington working for Public Citizen again. That's similar to the public interest research groups that I worked for right after college. And Public Citizen is a 100,000 member consumer group in Washington, D.C. I did some of their public relations for them for a couple of years. When it came time for me to consider getting married, and my fiance lived in Connecticut, I got a job at the New Haven Register, moved up back to Connecticut. And then from there is how I got to Maine. I applied for a job at the Kennebec Journal and got it, and we moved here in 2003.
Had you been to Maine before, or was it something where you just...
Of course.
And so you specifically wanted to... Most people Very here in Maine so. Are here. I found it's kind of interesting because there has to be some sort of deliberate affirmative step where there are other places. Like half the people in Dallas, I don't think, they could be in Houston, they could be in San Antonio, they could be in some other place, or Chicago, they could be in Cincinnati. But if you're in Maine, for most people, I've found that they're either born here and they love being here, which I love being here, or there's some sort of very conscious, very deliberate, like, I want to go to Maine, and it sounds like that was your situation from Connecticut.
Very much so. We want to live in, we want quality of life, and really for a journalist to own a home, there aren't many places, in 2003 when I came here that you could really do that. So the affordability, quality of life, those types of measures were really important when we came here.
So at some point in Connecticut, the soul-crushing traffic... The whole is it 95 that goes by?
Right. I used to drive between, Deep River, which is over by Essex and Old Saybrook, to New Haven every day. But I was lucky enough because it was a night shift. Right. So I was able to laugh at the people on the other side of the highway who were stuck in, three lanes of traffic.
But it's still soul crushing. I grew up outside of Boston. I was back last weekend for a basketball tournament and going down 128. Mm-hmm. And I think we take for people never really talk about Maine traffic because it's just not on the menu of issues, right?
Well, they do, but it's funny. It's like,
Franklin, Ontario.
There's a traffic light where there's, right. hasn't turned green yet, so cars are lined up behind it, and that's a traffic jam.
Well, in Portland, Franklin, Ontario, from 4:58 to 5:03 every day, apparently there's at least a 1 or maybe 2 minute delay. And so I think for a lot of folks coming out of Portland, that becomes their traffic nightmare, is if they're in from 4:58 to like 5:06. But it's so funny where you go to other parts of the country where that's in like the top three life issues. Like if you're working in New York and living in Connecticut, the whole process of getting up at 4 a.m, getting to the train station, getting the seat in the right car you want to be in, ignoring the people you want to ignore, shuffling through a subway, brushing against 1,000 people you don't want to have physical contact with.
That's brutal.
And then walking 2 blocks and then going up 36 floors because you got to get on the speed elevator and not the other elevator. And then just to go out to lunch, you have to, it has to be a long, detailed plan. on, and then these little tiny tables where people have lunch and everybody's elbows to elbows. Here in Maine, I mean, we have issues, and we have kind of an economic issue where we have a relatively weak economic engine, but we just take for granted the humanity part of it, where people can kind of spread out, enjoy life, and see the ocean, and space and our environment, I think, is so important to personal happiness and fulfillment.
Right. Well, you know, you're talking about people coming and people going from Maine. You know, you hear the dissatisfaction with the people who grew up here, can't wait to leave Maine. I'd say 80% of them come back. And they look at the rest of the country, they see what else is out there, and it's, you know, unless you have a job lined up for you or you're in a really good field, it's tough out there. And a lot of economy in Maine is, agrarian and family-oriented, small businesses. And so, you know, that's not really a bad way to go. And in terms of the economic engine, I think Maine's got a really good one. I just don't think we've attached the cars to the engine yet.
Well, let's talk about that in a sec, but let's talk about, you know, what brought you here in 2003 and then a couple of the newspaper roles you had. And then I want to talk about the state of journalism and print versus digital and new media, and then we'll talk about what you're doing. So
that's good.
So you started as editor at the Kennebunk Journal?
Yeah, Kennebunk Journal is the oldest newspaper in the state. It's the daily paper in Augusta, Maine. It's probably got about 10,000 circulation these days or thereabouts. It's part of the Maine Today Media chain, what is now called Maine Today Media. They own the Morning Sentinel in Waterville and, of course, the Portland Press-Herald. And I worked there at night 6 years, the assistant city editor, putting out the paper basically at night, making sure that copy was clean and deadlines were met. And deadlines were working well and designing pages and checking the night cop shift, you know, making sure that nothing burned down and things like that.
Years ago in Far Away, I wrote a column for Knight Ridder Tribune, a national column, 3 times a week. I think I wrote 500, 600 columns. And whenever I would turn it in, and in this case, it wouldn't be to a city editor, it would be to a sports or lifestyle editor, the vernacular was that they were called drones. I don't know if that was something common to the Kennebunk Journal. But every time I submitted a column, I thought it was Pulitzer Prize winning. And then every time it came back, the editor crossed everything out. I also had a problem with colon and semicolon, and they kept giving me these shrunken white books, and I kept throwing them away. They're, you know, the small, as you're familiar, is it the Bible of
elements of
grammar,
style.
Elements of style.
Right.
So I've got great respect for what you and other editors do, but when you're a writer and you're trying to write something, and then the editor just looks at it and tears it up, it's a little soul crushing.
I guess so. You know, there's probably layers and of redundancy that need to occur in the journalism business that prevent, you know, mistakes or, you know, bad things from getting in the paper. So I think most reporters understand that. And but at the same time, the economics of the industry are such that a lot of those redundancies are going away.
And we'll talk about that in a sec. And after the Kennebunk Journal, what was the next step in terms of your career path here in Maine?
Well, that's how we met, Steve. I started a small PR firm in 2012, and one of my clients was a state senator from Cape Elizabeth who ran for U.S. Senate and had a primary. That was a very crazy campaign, as you remember. She was Cynthia Dill, and she ran against Olympia Snow, and then when Olympia Snow dropped out, all hell broke loose and made for a very interesting time. I had a couple other clients as well, but that was what I did for 2012 or the balance of it.
Right. I remember during the summer of 2012 and going into the fall, there were 6 candidates on the ballot for U.S. Senator. Obviously, Angus King, who ultimately prevailed. He ran as an independent. Cynthia was the Democrat. Charlie Summers was the Republican. And there was myself and 2 other guys who were also independent. It was that the first time you had either worked on a campaign or kind of been on the campaign trail other than covering it from a writing or from a journalism perspective?
Yes. I mean, there were some campaigns that Public Citizen was involved with, but they were, you know, they were lobbying campaigns for Congress. They weren't really elections. So it was a different kind of...
What was it like being on the Cynthia Dill train? And by the way, Cynthia's been here since the election. She has joined a law firm in Portland. I don't recall the name, but she's doing well, and she tweets, and she's still actively involved in a number of issues, and she speaks out. And I've got a lot of respect for Cynthia Dill. But being on a campaign and being on a Senate campaign, particularly because there is a lot of focus, I've never been able to adequately explain it to people who are not kind of connected to it, because many, many voters just look at the process as people are campaigning, there's sound in the background, and then I go to the election, and I go to the voting booth, and I go, yes, I'm going to check for this person. But going to the debates, going to the events, meeting with county and town committees, it is a dawn to beyond dusk process. And what were some of your takeaways that you either learned or observed that you thought were interesting in working with, at that time, candidate Cynthia Dill?
Right. It is a very involved process, as you mentioned. There are a lot of things that go on, between the candidate and the infrastructure. Like you mentioned, the county committees, they're very important in Maine. County seats, county commissions, people that you want to see statewide that give voters the impression that you've got supporters, that you've got a network, that when you need to drive people to an event, that you can count on those people to organize it for you. You don't have to be there doing everything yourself. So a lot of networking, a lot of organizing, a lot of things behind the scene that when the candidate shows up and there's 15 people with placards behind that person cheering, there was some work that went into that, and it wasn't the candidate. They just show up. So there's a lot of advance work. There's a lot of things that they need for them to look successful.
Had placards behind me. So let me write this down.
Yeah.
You're saying the people behind cheering, waving placards.
It's a very important optic, Steve. Very important. All those supporters, the sea of supporters that you can't even see the end of behind you.
Depending on how you crop the photo, literally or
that's
figuratively,
yeah.
that creates the perception. Because if you crop it tight enough, the perception is that the image would bleed out into infinity.
Yes, that's right. An infinite number of supporters. That's definitely the image you're trying for.
Oh, fantastic. And what about the political realm of your role and what you saw? Because one of the things that kept coming up with Cynthia Dill, she won the primary. There
right.
wasn't much of a contest, so she was the Democratic nominee.
Right.
Part of what I think, and I'm not speaking for Cynthia, but it felt like she was a bit frustrated because she wasn't getting support from the party. Angus King, who although he was unenrolled or otherwise known as an independent, was getting more of the support directly or indirectly. And it felt like at times Cynthia was kind of hitting the table going, hey, I'm the Democratic nominee. Why aren't people supporting me more? It made for some interesting debates. Cynthia and I a couple of times sat next to each other, and there was one time where I took my shoe off.
I remember.
Yeah.
Great visual. I remember it still,
And Cynthia gave me a look as if I hadn't...
You're going to throw the shoe at her.
Well, I hadn't changed my socks for a few days. She looked at it with some level of disdain, and I wasn't trying to like...
Duck.
I know. So she was like, what are you taking your shoe off? I go, no, Cynthia, I want to make an example.
Yeah. But I thought it was good. I thought it was good theater and made people listen to what you had to say, which is what you're trying to do.
Well, but from the political standpoint, I personally wish, whether it was in that campaign or other campaigns, that we had a system that allowed people to say, I want to serve, here is what I believe, here's how I think I can help, and have that be the currency of campaigning. But because of the systems, because of the tribal nature of politics, because of whether it's partisan party politics or whether it's other variables, it doesn't really work that way. And in Cynthia's case, I think she was frustrated because she wasn't getting party support. And
right.
so from inside the campaign, talk a little bit about what that frustration was like. And at one point, I think she I don't want to say she attacked Angus, but she was aggressive relative. I think her, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was pretty close to being verbatim. She said something about old, rich white guys. And I was like, really? Old? Because you don't really hear that out loud too much, and you certainly don't hear it in a political campaign. But I think it was part of her frustration where she was trying to differentiate herself. But what was that part of the experience like for you?
Well, Cynthia's in it to win. She's a very competitive, very smart, tenacious person. So I think we all felt that if we won the primary, that would unlock some degree of support from Democratic Party, and that wasn't as forthcoming as it, you know, as we'd expected, and some of the, you know, language perhaps that came out during the general was, you know, voicing that frustration. But you know, the other thing is that, you know, there are messages and there are ways to deliver the message. And so right. I think what she was speaking to was trying to diversify Congress. You know, women's issues were very important to her. And, you know, so I think what she was speaking to was, you know, trying to get the main electorate to send someone to Congress who, you know, had a little different take on it, things.
Well, and as I mentioned before, since the campaign, Cynthia and I have gotten together for coffee and talked a couple times, and I have respect for her service when she was in the state senate, and had respect for she. I'm sure she will be cropping up in other places in terms of public service, and I think that'll be great for her, and hope she's successful.
Yeah, me too.
So after that, you returned to journalism as managing editor of the Times Record, is that
right?
And right up until recently, and
right.
Well, before we leave the managing editor, for listeners that may not be familiar in terms of how newspapers and journalism operates, talk a little bit about the role of managing editor, because people hear editor, and there's usually all kinds of different flavors and different levels and different silos. You know, sports editor is pretty clear, where that person oversees the content in the sports section. But when you talk about executive editor, managing editor, city editor, and editorial editor, talk a little bit about both in terms of your experiences. And so managing editor, I think, is the day-to-day person late at night. You look at all the stories. You look at how, what do you call them, slugs or openings in the, and you decide what goes in page one, what has the best photo for the story, what doesn't make the paper, and talk a little bit about the role of managing editor in a daily newspaper.
Mm. I think it varies greatly based on the size of the staff. We had a very small staff at the Times Record. I think we had seven full-time journalists all told. You know, we didn't have a staff photographer, or we didn't have a copy desk. There was very scaled down operations. So managing editors at other places, I think, have a lot of responsibility for vision and for community relations and for making sure no one gets libeled and you know, what goes on page one, and what are we doing for Sunday? You know, what's our big splash for Sunday? And so there's a lot more, I think, vision and planning that goes into being a managing editor at the larger places. At the Times Record, I was typing in letters to the editor and greeting people at the door, and you know, actually writing and reporting stories as well. So really first to last kind of responsibility, you know, not just visioning next week's paper, but and not just you know, putting tomorrow's paper together, but also actually contributing content for it, and patching holes, always patching holes in the news biz.
Great. You're listening to Times Smart Talk with Steve-O and News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Our guest, Bob Mensinger.
Much better this time. Thank you.
There's something about the vowels and consonants, and I really think Bob Smith may be the...
I'm going there. No. When I run for office, it's going to be Smith.
Oh, you're not even thinking about running for office, are you?
Someone mentioned it. Someone said that they had heard that I was interested, and I said I was not interested at the time, because first of all, I was moving to right. a different district. I lived in Mount Vernon outside of Augusta for 8-9 years, and that seat was pretty traditionally Democratic, and Dennis Keschel, who occupies that seat now, is a Republican, and they wanted me to run, and I was moving at the time, so I really, there was no way for me to do that.
But there may be in the future.
You never know.
I think that's I'd like to break some news here today, Bob. So if
not this time. Not 2014, that's for sure.
Okay, well, we'll have to break news in the following years. So recently you left the paper, and right. you decided to start, you know, or restart your PR firm, Writing
right.
Maine.
Right.
And talk a little bit about that and what the goal is for Writing Maine and what the focus is. And then I want to talk about what's going on in the media business in general.
Yeah, well, you know, my firm is really focused on campaigns, mostly progressive-minded companies and organizations. You know, I've worked with Maine Share, I've worked with Friends of the Maine Woods, which was a advocate for a public park in the North Woods, small, you know, energy efficiency companies, things like that. So that's really where my focus is, you know, on progressive small businesses and, you know, nonprofits and political entities that can, in my view, move Maine forward. So, you know, I'm looking for, you know, to represent those interests. I've got a couple, you know, things along those lines that are happening. And so, you know, moving forward, it's really all about trying to get what I view as Maine's future, get that developed through the people and the organizations I feel are, you know, those the vehicles that, that can do that.
Great. And you have a Twitter feed at Writing Maine.
Correct. Thanks.
For people that can, I feel a little awkward on Twitter. It feels like you're very comfortable. I feel like a 14-year-old on the turnpike for the first time where people are zipping around writing, you know, witty, pithy things. And I'm writing, I had a cheeseburger today. It was delicious. Any tips for social media from your experience in journalism?
It's dangerous. I'd say watch out. You know, anything you say, it's like having a conversation, only there's like a megaphone. You know, so anyone who follows you can take you what you said on Twitter, retweet it, and, you know, it's so it becomes an echo that you didn't.
It's a megaphone, but it's also indelible, which is something different.
Where you can delete it.
Captured. But once somebody captures it, and people are capturing everything, you take a snap, it never goes away.
It never goes away. And, you know, if you delete a tweet, someone could screenshot it or, you know, they can dig it out of the archive or something like that. So you really, really got to be careful. It's a very extemporaneous medium, but it stays forever. So be careful.
I know. I remember, the good old days when, in the old days it was you'd write something in the paper. It would be archived in the early days of computers, but it was more microfiche than anything else. And then, literally things faded away. They turned yellow. So when people say, well, you can't really give it some time. You know, it'll fade away. It literally, news and information faded away. But in the last decade and a half, we've moved into a digital era where things going forward for the rest of time will never go away, because once it's digitized and once it exists, it will never go away.
It's ironic because it seems so fleeting. I mean, it's once a tweet's gone, it's, you know, in your feed, you know, you're onto something else. I mean, you're the 140 character limit really kind of prerequisite for that is that you have a very short attention span, but that doesn't mean that, you know, other people aren't watching or that the thing doesn't get archived somewhere for someone to dig out 10 years from now and as proof you're a loose cannon or something like that.
But I agree with your assessment that it's a dangerous communication genre. But I also think as a society, there's some changes taking place in terms of people's tolerance or acceptance, or there are things that I see people tweeting every day or putting on Facebook that 10, 20 years ago, it would be, you know, it's like if your next door neighbor walked up and said, hey, guess what? This is what I'm wearing or this is what I did last night. You would look at him or her and go, why are you sharing that with me? But there's something about the distance, and it's not anonymity because people's identity are mostly attached, but it's almost like the space that digital media provides people where they don't have to own it as directly. It's almost like a persona. There's one step removed from that's not really me.
And you can pseudonym yourself to death and create identities that are semi-corporate and have a company like, you know, I'm Writing Maine on Twitter, although it also has my name attached to it. But you can be someone else on social media. And so that's a branding and identity thing where, you know, you can be someone who you're actually, you know, not, or who you want to be, or what, you know, what you hope to achieve.
Or bad things happen. What was his name? Carlos Danger, mayoral candidate in New York, who tweeted all the pictures.
Wiener?
Yeah. But he was, his name was, I don't know if it was Carlos Danger, but it was something, and all the late night shows, you know, made fun of it, but
you probably shouldn't be sexting pictures of yourself, especially if your last name's Wiener, right?
It's not good. Maybe that contributed to his issue. Maybe he thought he was inoculated because he had taken so much grief for the name Wiener that it triggered something, but whatever. That's,
you know, they say there's no bad publicity. I don't know if that's necessarily true.
Oh, I would say that's bad.
Yeah.
Whatever they say, they're wrong in that case. So let's talk about, you know, your experience here in Maine, operating in the highest level of journalism as a managing editor, as an editor, as a writer, a number of what I call real journalism. And I want to get your thoughts, because you've studied, you had a double major in journalism, political science. We've entered a period in the last few years where there's a lot of noise, a lot of voices. Newspapers introduce more voices, literally and figuratively. There's op-eds, there's people's have take, there's blogs that intersect the internet in print. But for the average reader or the average consumer of information, it feels like it's harder and harder to determine what is real journalism, which I would think you and your profession qualify as a real journalist, as a person who studied, a person who has worked at major newspapers, news organizations, where you have there's a combination of ethics, a combination of technical knowledge and grammar and skill and context, and also there are elements that, and it may not get it right all the time, but at least try to suggest impartiality. So for real journalism, when you are at either the Times Record or the Kennebec Journal, you may personally, as Bob, have a political view, a personal interest, but when you are operating as a journalist, unless you're a columnist and unless you're writing an op-ed where opinion is part of it, you're supposed to be removed from it and say, here are the facts, and whatever I believe about politics or Governor LePage or Mike Mishu, I'm presenting journalism. These days, it feels like it's harder and harder for an average person to separate, because it kind of looks the same. And if you're looking at it digitally, it's hard to differentiate between what did a reporter write versus what did an opinion or a blogger write. And what's your view on that from your experience and from somebody who's been part of it academically as well as professionally? Is it a good thing that more voices are coming out, or is it the sign that the start of journalistic apocalypse? If those are the two choices.
Yeah, I think it doesn't have to be bad. I think the democratization of media, as they're calling it, is not a bad thing. I mean, we've seen in foreign countries how crackdowns by governments have been tweeted out and led to, outpourings of, outrage and support for people who are protesting, oppressive governments and things like that. So certainly, information flow is best when it's free. But as you mentioned, professional journalism requires a fee, and it's not free. It requires people who are trained to know what they're doing. So is it a bad thing or a good thing? I think there needs to be some media literacy taught. I mean, I think people need to know that a tweet from someone who says that there was an 8.0 earthquake off Chile this morning, that person might say tomorrow that there was a 9.6 earthquake off Japan, and that wasn't true. And so, there's some sourcing issues with a lot of social media and a lot of alternative media that I think, consumers need to be aware of. I think that people are self-selecting. I think people get the news that they want, and that's dangerous. I think we're entering a period where unless something's reinforcing your views, you really don't want to hear it. And so you don't get a newspaper that gives a wide range of opinion and news. You get something like a group of Twitter followers that, will reinforce what you believe. So
for all the people that for the last 5 years have promoted, as an example, that President Obama was born in Kenya, and of course he was, how could he be born anywhere else other than Kenya? And sure, there's a birth certificate, a life certificate from Hawaii, and sure, there were doctors who have testified that, of course, and sure, there was newspaper notices that Barack Obama was born, and there's absolutely zero real evidence that he was born in Kenya. But if still 31% of the people out there believe that there's a chance that he was born in Kenya, with all the facts and all the details, and it's still such a high percentage of people just want to believe what they want to believe,
right?
That's the part that for me is frustrating, because it's less about was he born in Kenya or why, but if we can't accept certain truths, whether it's climate change or whether it's, and everything is up to debate, and everyone gets to say in the media, my view is just as valid as yours, even if it is unsubstantiated. There's somewhere along the line I want media to step in and go, it does matter. These other people are wrong, and it feels like that doesn't happen enough.
Yeah, I think, you know, what it comes down to is a market. It's everything's a market economy. It's a free market, supposedly. And so, you know, those people and outlets that are spewing falsehoods are supposed to go away eventually, you know, because they're just not worth listening to.
Unless they're owned by Rupert Murdoch and he's got billions of dollars reinforcing it as an example.
Yeah, you know, I think everyone's got an audience. You know, even people who think Obama was born in Kenya, you know, there's probably a very large audience of those people. So there's going to be in this media environment, a very fractured situation where, you know, you're not going to be able to disprove to some people, you know, that Obama was not born in Kenya. That's just what they believe. Everything that they read in the media, in their media, in the media they select, reinforces that. And so, you know, your larger point that the mass media being under attack economically today, I think, is a valid one, because there's very few common touchstones that we have as community for community these days. Right. Newspapers used to serve that. And if it was right, wrong, or indifferent, you could write a letter to the editor. You could, you know, suggest a different story, you know, and so the balance would hopefully occur eventually in a newspaper. Now the balance occurs when you look out over the broad expanse of the media landscape and take in everything, you know, then what is your decision? So really the media is really about trying to help people make better decisions. And, you know, social media doesn't necessarily take away from that. I think people have to be very, you know, careful consumers.
You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLAB, 1310 AM. We have Bob Mintzinger. He is the award-winning writer and editor, former assistant city editor and city editor of Kennebec Journal, also managing editor of the Times Record, recently started his own firm. Let's talk about the economics of journalism, because that's really what's driven a lot of these changes over the last decade or two. And obviously the technology of the internet has created a platform. But like everything else, economics plays a huge role. You know, I grew up watching 60 Minutes. And so if I watched a 60 Minute story, or Morley or Mike Wallace said, we're going down to the Panama Canal and we're talking, there would never be any real question about, you know, do they know what they're talking about? You just, it was so compelling. And you could, the sense of journalism, and I think in the last few years there's been some editorial mistakes, and they've some things have slipped through the crack, maybe trying to hustle through stories and be more competitive in a different era. But for the most part, over many, many decades, 60 Minutes was that electronically and broadcast. Wall Street Journal, New York Times are also papers where people say, okay, if it's in there, it means something. But in all those organizations and the papers you've worked at, in order to have real newspapers, Portland Press Herald, Bangor Daily News, Kennebec Journal, Times Record, real newspapers, you have to pay people. You have to many times have a building. You need to have computer infrastructure. You need to have photographers. So it requires a lot of money to create the capability, whereas when people blog and write anything, they can do it in a coffee shop on their handheld or whatever. And what has happened over the last decade or two decades is the fuel that's created those economics has been advertising. And advertising has gone away from print. It's gone, you know, like energy itself, it goes where it thinks it's most efficient. And across the board, in almost every area of traditional journalism, budgets have been cut. Reporters now have to take their own pictures. Editors are writing copy. Everything has been distilled down. And at some point, what do you think is the natural mechanism that people push back? Because if it's not driven by the consumer side, if consumers, when I say consumers, people who care about information, they care about reading and finding out what happened yesterday or what happened. But if we don't have an informed electorate and we don't have an informed consumer base that are pushing back saying, you know, you need to have more reporters. I want more detail. The information coming out of Augusta doesn't go deep enough for me to really understand how this bill is being debated. But absent that, how do you stop the trend? And it feels like the trend is still continuing, where there's fewer resources, there's more consolidation, there's more concentration, and I personally don't think that's good for democracy, because I think journalism isn't like other businesses where natural attrition and natural consolidation are part of kind of free market economics. Journalism is a key component of democracy because you can't effectively operate in a democracy unless you're getting good information, unless you're getting real detail. So to me, I think it's a much more profound change than other industries that have gone through. And do you think that the downward, I don't want to call it a spiral, but the downward trajectory is continuing? Do you think it's bottomed out? Do you think that there are better days before us? Or what's your feeling in terms of kind of the morality of journalism and what's happened in terms of today?
Well, what you're addressing is the fact that journalism is a public interest.
Right.
It's a public interest, but it's privately held. There are no, I wouldn't say no, it's NPR, ProPublica. There are some new kind of models out there, but it's a public interest pursuit that is run by private interests. So when the market can't support that, you've left the public interest in the lurch. So from my perspective, what is needed is a new funding model. I mean, we never asked readers to subsidize the news ever. When newspapers were 25 cents, it didn't even pay for the newsprint. It was just a token fee to, make yourself a commercial product, make yourself a little bit more valuable in the eyes of the consumer.
Create circulation numbers, right? So you could have a metric to sell advertising.
Yeah, right. The circulation number bought your ads. And then when the internet came, we just threw everything up online for free. So we've been training readers for a long time to expect free news, free professional news. So the market's saying that, we can't keep doing that. Someone's got to step in. And to my mind, it's the community. It's the reader. Reader revenue that I've seen is increasing at most newspapers that I've looked at. And the ad dollar is inexorably declining. So does one replace the other? No. And so you asked me about the death spiral in the future. Is it getting better? Not really, because advertising dollars are still going away. I think the print advertising field is very, very limited when it comes right down to it. When you consider all the different options that advertisers now have.
And all the major categories. Car used to be a big category for advertising, but anyone's buying a new car goes online, they research it, they price shop.
Yeah, Craigslist, you could probably say Craigslist killed, a third of the revenue of major newspapers, classified advertising.
Even movie ads. I remember it used to be a full page of movie ads, and nobody really says, hey, let's go pick up a piece of paper to look at movies. You punch something on your iPhone, you go online.
Yeah, and whenever you lose bits of this information and it goes somewhere else, you've made yourself that much less useful. So you've got to figure out a way to fund it, to keep it a complete package that people can use to navigate their daily lives. In my opinion, I think that there needs to be a new model that's a nonprofit funding model where the profits are not taken out and spread across a chain of papers or used to enrich the life of the owner, although that's certainly a free enterprise and that can happen. But I don't think, I think the profits... The operating budgets of most of these papers these days are so tight that those profits could be much better used, plowed back in to invest in new products and innovation.
But does it matter? But does it matter to the average person that you used a couple of words in the description in the last couple of sentences between information and news? And I think to me that's kind of a key nexus, because to me, news has to be in some way, I don't want to say certified, but there has to be some faith that if I'm reading something, that it meets some standard. Right. And then there's other stuff that appears in proximity, literally or figuratively, in the paper, online, and it's not differentiated by look or feel or texture. And so you've got news and information, and then opinion kind of fits in there.
Don't forget infotainment and advertorial.
Oh, where companies are basically paying to create a message that looks and feels as if it is impartial and it isn't biased by its own economics.
And newspapers are forced to look at these as viable funders. You know, if the Koch brothers said we want to take out a 6-page insert in the Times Record tomorrow, we'll pay you $20,000 to say whatever we want. You know,
there'll be a little tag at the bottom saying paid advertising. Yeah. But for many people, they would look at it and they would kind of absorb the content.
Sure. There's a whole industry in making advertising look like real news. I mean, that's a really strong tactic. And it works for a lot of people.
But how do we get people? You know, when we talk about people, you know, in Maine, we have 1.3 million people. And I'm not sure what the numbers look like in terms of people who read daily newspapers and what that looks like over the last 100 years or 50 years or 200 years. But when we talk about average citizens here in Maine and across the country, if people themselves or a high percentage of people, if they don't recognize that it's in their interest, if they don't recognize that understanding Affordable Care Act is different than socialism, as an example, and I personally am a supporter of Affordable Care Act and expansion in Maine, I've heard arguments from some people that are valid arguments, but the arguments that you hear about, well, it's a government takeover, it's socialism, to me, they aren't. It's not rooted in anything that.
I don't want to get started on that.
I know, but because it's frustrating. Same thing with climate change. I don't want to go down the climate change rabbit hole. But if I talk to 72 scientists that are part of the UMaine climate cross discipline, and they're not political, and they're these nerdy guys and gals with pocket pen protectors, and they go. Absolutely. We've got isotope research. We've got the polar caps. We've got ocean acidity. We've got temperature variance. We've got, the polar bears are telling us something. But people
still the deniers, right?
Still the deniers because some whack job scientist in Bismarck says, well, no, there's man-made cycles. And I looked at a ring in a tree and there's some sort of carbon dating thing. And then other people go, yes, we're going to present that as being real.
Right.
And if many people in the public are either desensitized or disinterested to find out what's real or not, I think that hurts all of us. I think it hurts, and when we talk about the political process, which you've been very involved with politics, I think that creates many of our own problems in the political system. And everyone wants to complain about people in office and government. But if we, the people, do not do our role, because we own the democracy, you know, 238 years ago, people died for the right for America to stand on its own. And people right this second are fighting around the world, giving up their lives to preserve our democracy and to help other countries achieve democratic principles. Mm-hmm. But if we don't care enough to really find out whether we agree with the Affordable Care Act or not, or whether we agree with some of the underlying things of climate change, but if we don't care about this stuff enough to try to find the truth versus reinforce our own biased opinions, I think it's bad. I think it's worse than just the industry of journalism hurting. I think it's playing an incredibly material role in the decay of modern day democracy.
Yeah. For me, on global warming, it's kind of like, you know, a lot of data would suggest that the planet's getting warmer, or at least the climate is changing. And I don't know how you would really be able to deny some of those facts, but the real piece of it to me is, so what? I mean, if you believe it's happening or you don't believe it's happening, the effects and the consequences are going to be so dire that I think you need to consider at least some mitigating actions. So you can not believe in climate change and still vote for, you know, flood insurance subsidies to be cut off because, you know, we shouldn't be building so close to the ocean, as was proven during Hurricane Sandy. On healthcare, socialism, I mean, before the ACA, I thought healthcare was pretty socialized because I belonged to an HMO that I paid premiums to every week. And never, you know, if I never needed care, I was paying into a system that was being used to help someone else. So to me, HMOs were, you know, as socialist as what we got now. The Obamacare was actually built on the private system. I mean, it was built on private, you know, existing private insurers and hospitals providing the care. So it really builds on a system of free enterprise to me, and actually provides more customers to these companies. I really don't understand what the big deal is with Obamacare, especially when people call it socialism. It's befuddling to me.
It's all befuddling. By the way, we have Bob Mensinger. He is award-winning writer and editor. recently started his own PR firm. You can find on Twitter, Writing Mean. In the next few minutes, you have an interesting background, both in terms of studying political science as well as journalism at George Washington University. You've written and edited some great newspapers. In the run-up to the 2014 elections here in Maine, give a little sense of your perspective now that you're not confined by your duty as an editor to show any kind of bias or point of view. What are your thoughts going into the election coming up in 2014 and in general relative to your experience in media in Maine in general? Do we have an electorate that is getting the right information, regardless of who they want us, whether it's the gubernatorial or whether it's local elections? What I've pushed for over the last few years isn't specific to I want people to vote one way or the other, but I want people to be informed. I just want them to have as much information as they can. And I actually have faith in the positions that I happen to support, obviously, and as a Democrat. But it's not about being partisan. I just want people to get information.
Right.
And talk a little bit about, you know, both your firm and political work that you may or may not be doing. You've worked with Cynthia Dill during her election. But what do you see the political landscape being here in Maine?
It's fractured. You know, I think, you know, the voter registrations go a third, roughly. And so that middle third, that unenrolled third, I think everyone's grabbing for. You know, in terms of the governor's race, you know, you got the Cutler Democrats, the people who left to support Elliot Cutler in 2012, and whether he can keep them or not will be key for him, as opposed to, you know, Mike Michaud being able to cement those, you know, bring those people back home.
I don't think the spoiler thing will happen. I think by the time we get to October, there's so much discussion and so much constant awareness that whoever's ahead, and I believe and I support Mike, I hope he's ahead, but there'll be a tipping point, like a light switch, not a dimmer, where in the beginning or middle of October, if Mike's ahead by 10 or 15 points, nobody's going to want to get to November before they make the decision. I think that people are going to say, Mike's ahead, let's all go with Mike. You have any thought on the kind of what's called the spoiler paradigm?
That'd be kind of the reverse Libby effect if, you know, people went back if they went, instead of going from Libby to Elliot last time, you're now going from Cutler to Michaud because of the inevitability factor, which to me was the only reason, not the only reason, but the largest reason why the surge for Mr. Cutler in 2012, it was obvious to people that Paula Page wasn't, you know, their choice and Libby wasn't going to do it, so they needed to do something else. You could be right. I think we're going to get to a point after the primaries where polls are going to start coming out, people are going to start looking, we might get a couple debates, we'll get some information on these folks, and I don't know. I think we'll get a three-way race in November. I don't think anyone's going to drop out. But that's just my opinion. I'm really interested in the U.S. Senate race. I think that Shana Bellows is a compelling candidate for that race because she does have some appeal to the so-called liberty wing of the Republican Party, who seem to be so upset these days at kind of moderate Republicans like Susan Collins. So that could be an interesting one to watch.
We've actually run out of time. I want to have you come back.
It was a lot of fun.
By the way, we've had Bob Mensinger. He is award-winning writer, editor, longtime Mainer. He's recently started his own PR firm called Writing Maine. You can find that on Twitter. And bobmensinger.wordpress.com. If you just Google Bob, his last name is spelled Mentzinger. I hope you come back sometime soon.
Absolutely. I'm counting on it.
Perfect. You've been listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Thank you.